terms of other announcements, as you can see, Linda's surgery went well. Shocked she could be in class today, but we're grateful. Rena was put off, as you know. Mounts Thursday. They're not going to do anything right now, which is good news. Seems to be controlling it. They may have to increase the beta blocker slightly, but that they'll have to work. That's trial and error, really, on each patient. You have to figure out what works and what doesn't. As I forwarded out, also you should know that Becky's run into a bunch more problems there with her mom. One of the caregivers, I guess, her son was killed. And so now she's trying to set up around-the-clock care, which may, apparently her mother does not have the insurance to pay for it. So pray about that, that God will work all that out, however that has to be done. Also, if you pray about Laura's trip back, it looks like there's going to be a snow and ice storm on Tuesday. And that's the day she leaves, so... But I guess you can always spend the night in Atlanta Airport. It's a fun place, I suppose. But we'd like to get her back safely, and her husband probably liked that too. And in that regard, just to remind you, there will be no class this Tuesday, the 27th. That one's actually on me. I'd forgotten we'd reinstituted Tuesday somehow, and scheduled a late evening or late afternoon evening trip for her, so we'll have to fix that. But so I wouldn't be able to make it. You can come, but I can't teach, so and I don't want to hear, I know we put up with it all the time, but I know what you're thinking. All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship here then, and let's move on. And certainly we appreciate all the prayers on all these fronts. Pete, if you want me to announce, it's under a little undeserved suffering on his job test, so pray for him that God will make his situation plain, what he's supposed to do or not do, and all that. Fortunately, nobody's being tested. I think Nicola never have another seizure? No?
Yeah.
Oh, he did have one? Okay. So,
yeah, but he's doing good.
All right, well, and in regard to that one, too, I wanted to let you know your prayers for Colin have been going very well, so almost seizure-free, but not quite, but still a great improvement. So that was what they were shooting for. Okay, let's look on here. We stopped there with point K about those who find their life. We'll find that God is going to honor obedience. We have these promises. Essentially, whatever you may be forced to lose, because sometimes it's not our choice. And in fact, and most of the time when it comes to separation, I can't remember too many times when I've thought, oh, good. I've generally been thinking, you're making a mistake. Often it's forced on us. We don't have to do it. Other times you have to make hard choices, particularly in the closest of relationships, the family. So Jesus, point L now, not only taught this doctrine, he applied it under the pressures his family placed on him to compromise the truth. Matthew chapter 12. Uh, 46 through 50. And while he was still speaking to the crowds, behold, his mother and brothers were standing outside seeking to speak to him. And someone said to him, behold, your mother and brothers are standing outside seeking to speak to you. And Jesus answered the one who was telling them and said, who is my mother and who are my brothers? And stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father who is in heaven, he is my mother and my brother, my sister, and my mother. And the thing that's obviously absent in that is that he doesn't call any man a father. He only had one father, as we all do, God, in that sense. We have earthly fathers. I mean, all of us had one of those. But here they were trying to pay a they were making a power play with Jesus. They were outside, and I don't know that it comes across as much here in Matthew as it does. I think it looks like it might be a perfect there. They had taken their stand outside. In other words, they were firmly fixed. They were trying to call Jesus out. They wanted him to respond to them. And so they had taken their stand outside and sent word in. And Jesus was supposed to drop what he's doing and run out and get him, because that's your mother, man. That's what people probably thought. And Jesus ignored them. Never did go out to see them. I assume they finally got tired and left. Jesus is not coming out. And so their little play, their little attempt to manipulate him didn't work. And he basically just left. And people say, well, that's cruel, ignoring your mother like that, is it? The woman was trying to tell him how to run his ministry, essentially. Well, actually, they were there because they thought he was insane. They wanted to get him locked up. They may have had a straitjacket with them. Who knows? But Jesus didn't even, he didn't give him the time of day. I'm not even bothering with this. And he turns and lets people know, the people that are important to me are the ones who do God's will. These are the people that matter. The will of my Father is what matters, not family relationships. And again, this has been used in some cases inappropriately to allow people divorce. Oh, and of course, this goes in conjunction with some of these wrong doctrines like right man, right woman. Oh, well, I wasn't married to my right man, so I'm free to divorce him and separate and go do my own thing. No, I don't think I see that in the scriptures anywhere. But people try it. Also, John chapter 2, this is where he... Mary is once again seeking, and this one actually preceded the other one there. This one was early on in his ministry in John. But there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And the wine ran out, and the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does that have to do with us?" Now, first, woman was not a normal greeting or address for your mother. And so he's kind of just, even with his address, he doesn't call her mom or mother or anything like that. He calls her woman, which is more impersonal, far more impersonal, even within the family setting. What does that have to do with us? Is this even any of our business in the first place? This isn't our wedding. We didn't throw it. So, but she wanted to let him know that she wanted him to do something. "My hour has not yet come," and his mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Well, Jesus went ahead, obviously, as we know, and turned the water into wine. And yes, it was alcoholic wine. And I know that from what the steward tells him. He said that what most people bring out the good wine first, and then they save the bad wine for later. And you've brought out the good wine now. What's up? And so, no, this wasn't just grape juice. It was good wine, very good wine. I wonder what we can have in heaven there. See? So, anyway, but she tried to put pressure on him, but he backed her off. He just, by calling her woman, he let her know, there's a distance between us now. And you're not going to tell me how to run my ministry and or my life. So Abraham is an example of a believer that initially failed in the application of this doctrine. Now, this is good to know. The believers fail and they can get past it. So just because you failed under this doctrine and won't separate from somebody that you really should, then ultimately you still have the chance to get it together. You can still make the adjustment. As long as you're alive, there's hope. So Abraham failed. And most people consider, when they look at the scriptures, they consider Abraham to be a great believer. And rightly so, I think. But he ultimately separated from his negative relatives. Back in Genesis here, what we have, and literally maybe better here translating this as a pluperfect, because Abraham's already on his way. He's already left Ur by now. They leave Ur back in chapter 11. And the Lord said to Abraham, the Lord had said would maybe be better here, but just to clarify. Go forth from your country. Separate from your geographic environment and from your relatives. Separate from them. Now, many of Abraham's relatives were believers. So this idea of, well, he's had to separate from them because their unbelievers are negative. No, they're negative believers. They're idol worshippers, many of them. But they were believers. You say, how can a believer be an idol worshipper? Well, ask the covetous person, huh? Anybody ever experienced greed? That makes you an idol worshipper, an idolater. So, but they were believers, but messed up believers. And believers God didn't want Abraham around. God doesn't apparently want us to... There's an object lesson here. Why didn't he just leave him in Ur and do all this? Well, obviously there's a much bigger plan, certainly, that involves the land grant and all that too. Go away from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And it's intriguing that he says it in that order, because I would have probably said, you've got to leave your father's household and all the rest of your relatives. I would have worked the other way, but the relatives of Abraham were the trouble. That was his bigger issue, I think. And go to the land which I will show you, and I will make you a great blessing. Well, if you back up into the previous chapter there, in chapter 11, and that's why I said this had happened in back in Ur, 31. So Terah took Abraham, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans. This is essentially Samaria, the cradle of civilization over there. It would have been in the land of Babylon. The Babylonians were the Chaldeans, or that was their root race, in order to enter the land of Canaan. And they went as far as Haran and settled there. And if you have a map, you'll find that Haran is not in Canaan. They traveled up north out of Ur and got up kind of north west of there, but they stopped and they settled down there for however long, we don't know. And settled there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. And see, Haran, and if you back up even a little further in this, God had issued, it's that pluperfect in chapter 12. God had issued the command to Abraham to leave, not to his whole, he told him to separate from your father's house. Well, why is the father going with him? Abraham failed. He didn't separate. And he let Terah still continue to call the shots. And so, they stopped at Haran up there northeast of Canaan and settled. And no doubt at the will of Terah. I don't think there's much doubt about that. And God finally takes Terah out. He dies. And this is one of the problems that you face if you're negative and you get in the way of positive volition. This is where the unbelievers and negative believers don't have enough of a fear of God. You want to get in the way of a positive believer, you better be real, real, real careful. Because God can kill you. And God's got the best interest of his positive believers at heart, and so he's going to do whatever's necessary if you want to go as far as you can spiritually. And I do. I think everybody here does. But Terah took charge of this deal, even though Abraham was the one given the command, and he told to separate from his father, his father's household. Nope, the father just moved the household with him. Well, that was a failure. And then, obviously, he gets there. And then in verse 5 of the next chapter, verse 4 actually, Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot with him. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Now we're not told how old he was when he left, or how long they were there. And Abraham took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, and all their possessions. Well, once again, now he's got a chance to cut all the ties with all the household, but he doesn't. He takes Lot with him. And allows him, or at least allows him to continue on with him. And then they came to the land of Canaan. And then in 13:9, if you look into the next chapter... And if you actually back up to verse 5 here, beginning at verse 1, at the first of the chapter there. Because these words are really, they don't look like much, but they spell out a lot. Abraham went up from Egypt, and Lot with him. At the end of the chapter there. Lot is with him. And then, now Lot, who went with Abraham, verse 5, I keep calling him Abraham, this was before the name change. Lot went with Abraham, and the land could not sustain them while dwelling together, for their possessions were so great they were not able to remain together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's. So Abram, verse 8, says to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brothers. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. The best words he ever uttered. Please separate from me. And he's polite about it. He doesn't say, hey, you're a spiritual numbskull, I'm dumping you. That's one way to go about it, I suppose. But he didn't. He was nice about it. And you pick which way you want to go, Lot. And here's what this, and then this shows light on the character of Lot. Lot picks the place of temporal advantage. He is looking out for Lot. And so he picks the place that he thinks is going to be the best for him. He's not worried about Abraham, frankly, in that sense. And so Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of the Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So Lot, and these words are very telling, Lot chose for himself. All self-centered. That's Lot. He chose for himself the temporal advantages that could be gained by living in Canaan and moving his tents, as you'll see in verse 12. Thus, well, the great deal, they separated from each other. Boom, finally it's done. Now Abraham is compliant. And one of the first things that happens is God now reiterates the covenant terms with him. Because now Abraham's compliant. Because this was a conditional covenant in the beginning. You go forth and you do this and this and this and this. And if you do this, then I will do this and this and this. And so it was conditional. But it became unconditional when Abraham had complied with the particulars of the covenant. And this was the last piece of the puzzle, separating from Lot. And so they separated from each other. Abraham settled in Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley and moved his tents as far as Sodom. Boom, boom, boom. That's what you should read there. You should hear those ominous notes when you read that. Because we know what the Sodomites were known for. It's not hard to figure out. Now, after Lot, verse 14, the key element here, after Lot had separated from him. Now, he says, lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. For all the land which you will see, I will give it to you and your descendants forever. I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth. And all of that. So now the covenant is in force and effect because Abraham has complied. So now it's no longer conditional, now it's unconditional. And all the blessings of the covenant are going to come to Abraham, of course, and his descendants. And we know God's still got work to do there. Not done yet. Well, in the believer must understand and believe the principle that God will establish sound relationships with other positive believers. These are the relationships that ultimately are satisfying, since they are built on the foundation of doctrinal truth. Mark 3. You know, and this may just be the parallel to that one in Matthew now that I think about it. Yeah, it is. I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. Well, this is just Mark's version. But Mark does give you the a little heads up. Back in the earlier part of the chapter, he tells him that his family, essentially, verse 21 it is, he was doing such great things that they couldn't even sit down to eat a meal properly. And verse 21, when his own people, that is his family, his mother and brothers, heard of this, they went out to take custody of him. For they're saying he is insane. And that was their readout on it. And by the way, do you think your negative relatives think you're sane? They probably think you're in some kind of a weird cult. It's the only mind control cult that lets you think for yourself. It's a real failure as a mind control cult. I was accused of that. This goes back to when I was a fundamentalist Baptist. One woman who, 6 months before, of course, I was the greatest thing since Frosted Flakes. 6 months later, I can't do anything right, and everybody in the church was Ron's robots. Because that's how it's always worked for me in the ministry. People just obey me no matter what I say. It's always been that way. No. And that's the insanity of it. Their readout on this stuff is wrong. And then that's one of the problems you have with negative volition. They're not in touch with spiritual reality at a certain level. And so their views are skewed. Skewed, unfortunately, towards the cosmos in many cases. But that's the way that goes. So there, that's where he had to separate from his own parents. He practiced what he taught too. He didn't duck this and say, well, it doesn't apply to me. He applied the same doctrine he taught us to apply. Well, dating marriage and the doctrine of separation. Under the principle one that forbids being unequally yoked together, believers are not to pursue or establish marital relationships with unbelievers of the opposite sex. Now, that's 100% on that particular one. That's never allowed ever. The Bible never sanctions it. Anybody that marries an unbeliever, they have certainly violated God's directive will. There's no way around it. Then, unfortunately, absent any other changes, they're stuck in that relationship. They've imprisoned themselves with a negative unbeliever. Now, maybe if the woman's positive or the husband's positive, and then the wife or the husband, either one, gets enough of it, they may just go ahead and leave. Well, no, I'm tired of this church stuff. I don't want to hear about God. Leave me alone. I want out of this. And then, of course, you're free in that regard. Unfortunately, you have to remain unmarried the rest of your life. That's the biblical doctrine on it. So, again, anytime you marry an unbeliever, you have completely blown it. You can't justify this at ever in the Scriptures, of marrying an unbeliever. Two, since positive believers should avoid becoming entangled with negative believers, because bad company corrupts good morals. One should not initiate a romantic relationship with a negative believer. That's 1 Corinthians 15:33. Bad company corrupts good morals. So how do you know if a person's positive? Well, first you put their feet to the fire. I'll go out with you maybe, but this is contention upon our doctrinal life. Are we going to pursue sound doctrine? That's my life. Whether it's the woman or the man, you have to make this and lay it down, lay the law down, and all of this. So, can you marry a negative believer? Well, sure, you can. Is it the wisest thing to do? I don't think so. I think you're going to miss out on certain things. But unfortunately, that's just the way life goes. We have to realistically acknowledge this happens. And these are not second-class believers, even if they've done this. God, they're alive. God's working in their lives. They still have potential growth and all of that. So while we don't encourage it at all ever, if people do it, well, what can I do? That certainly is not a reason to throw anybody out of the church. Assuming all things are equal, they're nice and they're, you know, don't disrupt things and all that. If you get a problematic person, that's a different deal. But assuming all things equal. Well, we just encourage you, don't start a romantic relationship with a negative believer. First, put their feet to the fire. I would almost say, if you aren't in Bible class for 6 months, I'm not interested. We'll evaluate after 6 months and go from there. But when people are in love, all the little hormones run out the brain and go elsewhere. And so that's the way it is. But most people won't play hardball on this, because they get emotionally involved in it. And their emotions begin to run their deal rather than the doctrine. So, for three, all believers must learn to wait on the Lord in general. And this is no more true than in the divine institution of marriage. Four, remember that it is better to be single, fulfilling God's plan in time, than it is to compromise doctrine and get into a relationship that may become a real cause of grief. And all of those, I think, in Proverbs deal with marriage, a relationship that isn't satisfying. As a ring of gold. And see, this is what men typically look for. What do they look for? The overt package. Does she look good? You know, and they do all these studies all the time, or they'll have every once in a while somebody go out and dress in a fat suit. And guess what they found out? Pretty people get treated better. Wonder if the world's always been like that. Yes, it has. As a ring of gold in a swine's snout, so is a beautiful woman who lacks discretion. That's not the kind of woman you want. If she lacks discretion, you're in trouble. She's going to say and do things to get you in trouble. Proverbs 21:9. And you can reverse this to some extent. A ring of gold in a swine's snout, so is a pretty man, even if he's a model. If he hasn't got any spiritual sense, he's not worth having. I don't care how pretty he is. Or handsome, if you're a man, I suppose you're supposed to be handsome. 21:9. It is better to live in a corner of a roof than in a house shared with a contentious woman. And again, I can reverse this one. Better to live in the corner of a roof than a house with a contentious man. Because they're both bad. So we don't want to be contentious. Don't want to be argumentative, fighting constantly. Well, that's what it is. That contentious attitude. I'm willing to fight. And we all have to struggle against that. And we all know how to push. You know, those of us who have been married for quite a while, we all know how to push each other's buttons. We know where they are. We know how to make a little comment. You don't even have to say anything real mean. Just make a little snarky comment that you know inflames the situation. And keeps it going. And is designed to elicit a hostile response. And we all know how to push these buttons with each other. And we have to avoid all that. Also, verse 19, same chapter. Again, better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and vexing woman. Same thing's true of men, though. Better to live, better to be off alone is the idea. And 27, you're better off single and happy than married and miserable. A constant dripping on a steady day of steady rain and a contentious woman are alike. He who would restrain her restrains the wind and grass soil in his right hand. If she won't control herself, you can't control her is sort of the idea of that. How can you control the wind? How are you going to carry oil in your hand? No. It's going to run through. And the same thing, the woman has to work on this. This is what we're going to see coming up. We're going to get a big dose of this. Only the wife can work on her shortcomings. No, I'm in charge of her. I can work on them. No, you can't. You're not even called to, strangely enough. And we'll see all that. And only a husband can fix his. You can't fix your husband. You can't fix your wife. But this gets us all. This gets people off of what's the real issue. I need to be working on me. What's my relationship with the Lord like? Why am I feeling the things I'm feeling? Why am I doing what I'm doing? Well, you're the only one you can fix. And that has to be done under the ministry of doctrine and the Holy Spirit. You really, the flesh can't fix the flesh. It has to be done doctrinally, from the inside out. And for people who are, 20, 30, 40 years before they got with doctrine, 40, 50 years old, whoever, however long you lived, you develop some really bad cosmic habits. Because that's just the way life works. You live in a home where maybe it's a matriarchy. Well, you're going to grow up and want a matriarchy. That's just the way it is. And women in charge ain't the way it's supposed to work, sadly. So again, here the real blessings in life come to those that honor God and apply His word to these issues. Proverbs 19:14. House and wealth are an inheritance from fathers. They can hand you down some stuff. One thing they can't get you is a good wife. A prudent wife is from the Lord. And God blesses relationships. And this is something I've always prayed for. It's been on my prayer list. If a person's single and there's a relationship for them, I pray that God will provide it. That's part of shepherding. You want your sheep to be happy. I'm not here to make people miserable. You want them to be happy and blessed. And if you have a good wife, it's way easier to be blessed then. Believe me on that. I can testify to that one. And I can't read all of it. We're not going to read all of it. Proverbs 31:10, of course, sets the tone for what a real woman is supposed to be like. The doctrinal woman, the excellent wife, and how valuable she is. And I can't trace out every little detail, but from what I saw, this deal of Sam's, stay-at-home moms, if the figures I got are correct, that a stay-at-home mom, if you factor in all the stuff she does, and you had to hire a pro to do that, you had to hire somebody to do it, that she'd make like $150,000 a year. So, you got a chauffeur, you got a doctor in the house when the kid's getting their knees, you got a cook, you got somebody cleaning. And so let's see, if you figure if you're cleaning, you make $25 an hour. How long does your wife clean all week? So that's just the cleaning. And then, to get you a professional chef, Somebody who can cook for you? That's going to be pricey. And so I don't know if the figures are absolutely correct, but the point we're making is that a doctrinal woman, a high caliber doctrinal woman, is worth so much more than you can even imagine. How do you really put a dollar figure on companionship and unity and peace and all of that that you have in a sound marriage? So P1 cannot appeal to this doctrine as a justification for refusing to honor father and mother, since that relates to the matter of providing physical support for one's aged parents. It is not a command for adults to obey their parents. This I've heard from many, many idiots. You'd be shocked at how many times I've heard this. Oh, I'm just honoring my father and my mother. What are you talking about? Oh, I'm just doing what they tell me. That's not honoring your father and mother. That's being stupid. And particularly if you're the man in the household, it's stupid. They're not to be running your life. So 1 Timothy 5:4, but if any widow has children or grandchildren, they must first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. And that's probably laetates, acceptable. God really likes this, is the idea. And of course, it doesn't mention here whether they're believers, unbelievers. None of that matters. This transcends separation, this one. And again, there's one other one, and that is the marriage, which I'll put that in here too, and that's in 1 Corinthians 7. Also, verse 8 here, though, first, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Well, those are pretty strong terms. And but this is not a command that, oh, if my parents whistle, I got to run. No, your parents are to be out of your life. Separation is to be enforced in that regard as much as you need to, because they're not to be running your life. A man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and the two will be one flesh. And then the next point, Q, is going to be 1 Corinthians 7. That's in the marriage thing. But some of these things are not in this doctrine because I figured them out after I wrote the doctrine. 1 Corinthians 7. And this is all pretty straightforward here. To the unmarried and to widows, verse 8. It is good for them to remain even as I, that is, single and celibate. Now, that's not everybody's niche. In fact, that's not most people's niche in life. But if you're in that niche, that is a niche to has a lot of advantages to it that you don't have when you're married. Is it better to be married or unmarried? They both have advantages. It depends on your situation. It depends on the God's will for your life. For Paul, it was far better to be unmarried. And Peter was married. So there's no norm even among the apostles. It's just whatever God's will is. It's like Jesus and John the Baptist. Jesus comes, hey, he's a drunkard and a party guy. John the Baptist, he's demon-possessed. No, neither one was correct. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry. In other words, it's better to marry. Still, you have to marry a believer. You can't just go off saying, well, I have a problem with sexual lust, so I got to get married. And then go marry an unbeliever. That's not the way to do that. But to the married, I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. And this passage has been called the Pauline privilege, in that some people advocate that it's teaching you could have a separation, but not divorce. That separation is not taught in here. What's being dealt with is divorce. And the rules on divorce haven't changed. Paul doesn't give some compensation here that the Lord doesn't give, or some dispensation for you to get out of it. The wife should not leave her husband. That means she shouldn't divorce him. But if she does leave, i.e. she divorces, the fact that leave means divorced is proven by the next statement. She must remain unmarried. She's divorced him for whatever reason. Or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. But to the rest, I say, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever and she consents to live with him, he must not divorce her. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to live with her, she must not send her husband away. Now, if the husband decides to leave or the wife decides to leave, as you're going to see here, you're off the hook. Yet, verse 15, if the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. Just down hit the road. But this is where you have to have some real doctrinal moxie and some iron in your soul to make. This would be a tough situation. We can talk about it clinically here, but when you're personally involved in this, it's hard. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. You're not under bondage to stay married. But if they're negative and they're unbelievers, if they will stay in the marriage and not uproot the household and destroy it, then you're to stay in it. Now, they decide they're going to tear the marriage apart. They're going to drag you off to Timbuktu. Nope, you don't have to do that. They're leaving. And physically, that's manifested by relocation. They're leaving. And no, you stand your ground doctrinally and spiritually. But you get people, one, this has not been taught in some cases at all. Number two, it's been badly misinterpreted. The Pauline privilege doesn't exist that allows for separation. And the rules are all still the same. Even if you're divorced, you're supposed to remain unmarried. That's God's will. Now, if that doesn't work out, well then, there's still grace after divorce, strangely enough. Hey, is there grace after every sin? Yeah, as long as you're willing to forgive, there is. What sin can you commit that God wouldn't forgive you for? I can't think of any. Because, number one, the average positive believer doesn't want to run around sinning anyway. I've never thought, oh boy, sinning's really helped me. It's got me a lot of stuff in life. It's really cool. No, not really. So Q here, that's Q's going to be my other point. I have to. Conclusions. So just to say that this doctrine is trumped by marriage at that level. This doctrine of separation. But there is an escape clause, and that is if the negative person wants out, you let them go. You certainly don't compromise doctrine and go with them. That'd be crazy. You cut yourself off from your spiritual source. That's insane. Well, conclusions here. There can be no doubt that the doctrine of separation is taught throughout the Bible, and that it is an issue brought on by the very nature of the angelic conflict. There are several sound reasons to apply this doctrine when it becomes necessary. One, to protect his believer and his family from corrupting influences. Bad company corrupts good morals. We have good reason to apply it, and that is safety and security of your family. Spiritually, safety and security. Two, to attempt to bring the maladjusted to their senses. That's another reason for applying it. There are people who are irregular soldiers. They are unruly. They are not following their marching orders, and yet they feel justified. Separation is a way of telling them, no, you're not justified. You're not justified in abandoning God's plan because of the current cosmic crisis. Whatever it may be, and that'll be changing in 6 months probably, or a year, to a new one. And isn't it funny, all of this just trumps the whole concept of the election coming up. Trumps, that's pun intended. So, how many things have gone on? Let's see, how much more have we got? And they're fixing to pass another one. How much money is being blown around here that's funny money, too? Not just money, but funny money. We just print it, and there it goes. And then, the economy is being artificially manipulated by the Fed. And at any rate, we see all that. But that doesn't give us excuse to say, well, we don't have to assemble anymore. This is all dangerous, is it? Or can God protect positive volition? Even in dangerous times, God can protect us. Now, I don't advocate that we be stupid either. We've kind of gone with our guidelines, but the virus, unfortunately, has got to run its course. And people look for these magic bullets and they think they're going to fix it. And they're just not going to, frankly. Well, we'll see, but I wouldn't be running out to take that first round of vaccines, I can tell you that. That's just me, though. That's not God's will for you. I don't care if you take it. I'm just not going to. To bring them to their spiritual senses, this is the guy who came to his senses, the incestuous Corinthian. He's both a good example and a bad example. Don't marry your stepmother. That's a bad example. But then when you're called out on it, break the relationship off. And I didn't see Paul tell him, well, you know, that marriage is not legal in that place, so let him run across the state line and get married. And then let him back in. No, I've seen that played out. That's one way people try to get around this, when God's jamming them and won't let them get married. They don't have that rule down here, but they've got it in some of the more Bible Belt states. If you get divorced and there's children involved, you can't get married for 6 months or a year. I can't remember what it is. And so they get around it. Well, we can't get married in Oklahoma. Run to Texas. Yeah, that's it. That's what God envisioned. We can't get married. So, yeah, don't let this stop you. And people have it. But then he's a good example. He came back, broke it off. Paul didn't tell him, hey, just make this legal and then you'll be okay. No, he didn't tell him that at all. And then three, to fulfill the commands to apply it. First, this is also part of our royal imperatives. We have commands to apply this. And this is obedience and remain within the directive will of God. An adjusted believer does not desire to become God's enemy. I think. I hope. Adjusted believers should not want to make God mad. And of course, James, in his typical unassuming way, low-key, you adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? No, some people don't, apparently. No matter how many times I've taught it, they don't seem to get it. Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world constitutes himself an enemy of God. You do it yourself. Nobody has to lift a finger. So this is why the cosmos, again, it's just an expression of Satan's perverted genius and his darkness and all of that. And our warfare is not against flesh and blood, but against these powerful, unseen forces that manipulate humanity. And see how much they'll take. Well, see, failure to apply this doctrine impartially adversely affects spiritual growth and the witness of the life. One should avoid all associations that compromise Bible doctrine. Again, any clubs, associations, business partnerships, marriages, any of this stuff is off limits for unbelievers. All unbelievers are off limits for that stuff. And the vast majority, as we know, of the world are unbelievers. Some of them will give lip service to their saved, but you'll know them by their fruits. But no fruit, probably no salvation. I mean, we can't say for 100% certainty, but that's how Jesus would have judged it, I think, from the overt proof. Well, D, when dealing with other positive believers in the local church, the believer should recognize that isolated failures in any area are not necessarily grounds for separation. There are going to be people whose personality rubs you the wrong way. There are going to be people who you may not like. They may not be your cup of tea. There are going to be people who actually do things wrong to you, who may sin against you. But as a rule, for the group I've got here, I don't see any reason for anyone here to apply separation towards each other. In a healthy church, there is no need for that. Unless the other believer starts to peel off, becomes unfaithful and all that, well then yeah, you got to apply it. But for the faithful that are here all the time, there's no reason to apply this doctrine at all that I can see. And then, things will happen. And again, you may not necessarily even like it. See, people get saved. They had this back when it was Fundy, of course. It was all contrived and artificial. You know, every time we had a church service, we were told to go greet those, all you members stand up and you visitor, you stay seated. And we had to go greet them and hug them and, whatever. And we wanted people to feel welcome, I suppose. But people are welcome in Bible class. We're not here to make anybody feel unwelcome. We want people to make it. At least I do. So again, isolated failures. We're talking about somebody in terms of separation that have to be bringing reproach on the assembly. Again, a big enough sin you would take to the leadership and say, I think the guy may have to be put out. Or girl, whatever the case. Minor things, we have to learn to live and let live, absorb offenses, and move on. We're all going to offend each other from time to time. We say things without thinking. We do things without thinking. We can be insensitive. I don't have that struggle, but I know some of you do. And I pray for you. But of course I know I do. I can do all these things, of course. And so we have to learn to overlook. Forgive and forget and move on. That's our general rule of thumb. Generally speaking, if people are in class, pursuing NPR, are oriented to the pulpit and applying, then there should be no reason to withdraw fellowship from them. Just because you don't like them, that doesn't mean you have to run around and associate with them. But if you are placed into a social setting with them, you treat them just like any other brother. Even though, again, they may not be your cup of tea. But we would treat them just the same. But again, if you've got people, generally speaking, as the group assembled here today is, I don't have that problem. We don't have that problem. It's when you get malcontents, you get people in here who have an agenda and don't want to do all this, well, then that becomes the problem. So F, in any questionable situation, the believer should pursue God's will through prayer, seeking divine guidance, attendance in Bible class, and the counsel of adjusted believers if necessary. And I heard this years and years ago, and I found it to be true. If you have a question about something, and three or four positive believers around you are telling you the same thing, that's God's way of trying to get through to you. Just like he did to Paul. Remember that little ill-advised trip to Jerusalem? How many people told Paul, don't go? How many positive believers were around him saying, don't do this, the Holy Spirit says don't do it? And Paul says, oh no, I'm a martyr. I'm the great apostle. I know better than everybody. I'm going. Okay. We'll give you a little 5-year timeout. How about that? And Paul got a 5-year timeout for that. Now, he still conducted his ministry to the best he could from his situation. But do you think, let me ask you this, would you rather be under house arrest or free? And house arrest, you can't go anywhere. Just like the quarantine. Only you can't even go out and buy groceries. You leave the house and that's it. You're done. But I would rather be free. And I bet you money Paul would say the same thing. I'd rather be free. But he had believers in his face telling him, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And he was smarter than all of them. Well, that's one of the ways God tries to get through to people. The counsel of other believers, adjusted believers. So God will bless one's mental attitude, desire to please him. That I fully believe. God will bless your attitude if it's right. When the believer comes under pressure by separating from the negative and lukewarm, he should remember Proverbs 24:19 and 20. And you'll have losses in life, we all do. But God provides better. Do not fret yourself because of evildoers. And don't be envious of the wicked. Oh, it might look like they've got it all now. It might look like they're fine. Might look like God's for them. He's not. But there will be no future for the evil man. The lamp of the wicked will be put out. His life will be extinguished. It will become as nothing. And as we know, Solomon says people are good at this already anyway. The normal human race is good at this. A generation comes, a generation goes, nobody remembers. This is why we're destined to repeat history, because nobody seems to remember it anymore. And what history we do have is being changed by revisionist history pretty frequently. We just rewrite it to suit us. That's why we're going to take down all these Confederate statues. I don't care one way or the other. But that's a part of our history. Well, we're going to blot that out. Are we? Why? Why are we trying to blot out part of our history that brings us to where we are now? That's people and their human good, human viewpoint, do-goodism. We're going to rid the world of racism. Oh, good luck on that one. It's only existed since the time of Adam and Eve. It wasn't long before there were different races and they didn't get along. Certainly you see it at the Tower of Babel. They couldn't communicate. So sure, people may be doing fine out there. You may see negative unbelievers or even negative believers, and God appears to be blessing them. Don't presume that he is. Don't make that mistake of being superficial. And that's what Jesus told them, the religious leaders of his day. You're superficial. You judge according to appearance. And appearance isn't always correct. So H, further remember the blessings that are promised to those that apply the doctrine. Psalm 1. One of the first things we looked at here, because this psalm, ironically enough, don't you think it's funny that out of 150 psalms, the first one deals with the doctrine of separation? Doesn't that seem strange? Well, not strange, but... How blessed is the man that does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. His delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. And in whatever he does, he prospers. Well, do you want to be on that end of the equation? But the wicked are not so. They're like the chaff. They're going to get judged. They're going to be blown away, and their place will be found no more. It'll be as if they didn't live, I guess. And the Lord knows, verse 6, the way of the righteous, the way of the wicked will perish. Mark, we've looked at that one. That's what, if we've given it all up, what's in it for us? Yeah, well, here's what's in it for you. Blessings in time, blessings in eternity. And then the last one there, 2 Corinthians, we'll be done today. The promises associated with that passage regarding the passage that really promotes separation. So the idea is, if you apply this, the first things he's pointed out here, back in, do not be bound together with unbelievers. That's as clear as any verse in the scripture. You don't need anybody to exegete that for you. It's very plain. And he points out that any violation of this violates fundamental principles of the angelic conflict. But for those who will abide him, we are the temple of the living God, verse 16. I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God and they will be my people. Therefore, come out from that their midst and be separate, says the Lord. But we've always got that cosmic pressure, peer pressure, to conform us to the devil's world. Do not let the cosmos squeeze you into its mold. And they're constantly trying to do it, both knowingly and unknowingly, because they're being manipulated by superior forces. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will welcome you. I will be a father to you, and you will be sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty. And obviously, this must go beyond the simple relationship of salvation, because all people are sons and daughters of God by spiritual birth. But there's a level to this relationship that's deeper, that's more intimate, that most people will never get, because they're not sold out to God and His plan. And so he said, I will come and dwell with you. I will live with you. He who has my commandments and keeps them, this is the one that loves me. And my Father will come, and we will make our abode with him. He'll live in your house. He'll be with you in ways that he's not with these people who don't pay attention to his plan. Okay, well, we got through that, so we'll be ready to take up here again. Remember, not Tuesday, but Wednesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth and future glory, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.